If you are suffering today, first, welcome to the human race. Our guest says to be human is to suffer. So the outcome of a program on suffering, you would think, would be less suffering, right? 10 steps to overcoming your struggle, your anxiety, how to avoid the suffering you had yesterday, or how to at least turn down the volume on the suffering so that it becomes more manageable. Sadly, our guest today is not going to offer you that. He would probably be much more popular if he did offer that, because we all want less suffering. We want an easier life. Isn't that what we signed up for? And I wonder if in my own life and in the lives of fellow believers that I've walked this trail with, if we don't promise something about the Christian life that frustrates us and those we ask to join us, we believe something about God and what He offers that isn't actually true. We don't want to suffer, and we don't understand why God allows it or even puts it in our paths, and we want it over with and done. So our guest today does not promise that by listening to him in this hour, you will suffer less. But if you, however, and a friend of mine used to say, there's always a however in life. However, if you listen closely and carefully and enter into his thesis, he does promise you will suffer differently. And I don't know if that helps you or makes you want to throw the radio, turn the radio off. I hope you'll keep it on, because that's what we're going to talk about today at the Radio Backyard Fence. Our program's recorded. What you just heard is how I opened the program toward the end of August last year, and a conversation with Kurt Thompson. We'll get to that straight ahead. Let me thank Ryan McConaughey doing all things technical. Let me thank Tricia for her work as a producer. A little inside information here. When we go back to the program, you're going to hear our dog, Mr. Bingley, barking in the background. So we are not hermetically sealed. This is real life radio, okay? So listen for Bingley. And listen, friend, we need your help at the Radio Backyard Fence. Have you gotten a copy of Memorizing Scripture by Glenna Marshall? It's our thank you this month. 866-95-FABRY is our number. Or go to chrisfabrylive.org. Glenna says, we never study God simply to acquire knowledge, and we don't memorize Scripture simply to be able to recite it. No, the bedrock of both study and meditation is relationship. And that's what we want to foster with you. Get a copy of this Memorizing Scripture. I would love to send it to you. Just call us, 866-953-2279, or go to chrisfabrylive.org. Become a backfence friend or partner today, chrisfabrylive.org. Dr. Kurt Thompson is a psychiatrist, speaker, author of books on shame, desire, and the anatomy of the soul. He's board certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. He graduated from Wright State University School of Medicine, completed his psychiatric residency at Temple University Hospital. He's written a number of books. The one we're going to talk about today is The Deepest Place. It's got a gorgeous cover. Suffering and the Formation of Hope. Dr. Thompson, sign in here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm grateful to be on the show with you today and looking forward to having a chance to talk about what's going on in the book.
Psychiatrists are supposed to fix things. You're supposed to give us something. You're supposed to tell us something to take the pain away, and you're not going to fix our suffering. That doesn't make me real happy.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's not just a matter of like, am I going to disappoint someone today? It's a matter of like, how many am I going to disappoint? So people can, you know, for the most part, probably line up in this regard, because I think we, you know, we live, Chris, in a world in which we are being trained and we have been trained to believe that, first of all, that we shouldn't suffer. And that if we are suffering, this is not new, right? This is Job. If we are suffering, there must be something wrong in the world. And we also, though, have almost an infinite array of options at our disposal that will help distract us from our suffering. You know, beginning with the little supercomputer that I carry around with me in my pocket. And I think what's significant in the work that I'm doing is that, you know, the Christian story is the one story in the world, the only story in the world in which suffering is honored, in which we say that God actually is in the business not of disdaining suffering, not of blaming us for our suffering, but of being with us in our suffering, and in so doing, transforming not just us, but our notion of suffering at the same time, which I think is really good news. It's difficult news, but it is good news because suffering is as true, is as common. It's going to be as human as having a pulse. And suffering, in many respects, we might say, well, why do we suffer? Why does suffering exist? In some respects, I would say that suffering is the mirror image, the painful mirror image of God's intended vision for who we were to have become in Genesis 1 and 2. And instead, given the choices that we've made over time, we find that our suffering, or as we like to say in the business of psychiatry, suffering is our response to pain over time. The way we respond to our pain over time is shaped by so many more things than the gospel. And as such, I find that my responses to suffering are ones in which I simply typically just want it to go away or find some way to blame someone else for it, just so long as I don't have to endure it.
It's okay. It's okay for Job to go through this, or for anybody in the Old Testament, or even the New. But it's like for me, no. And you, the whole book is basically the first few chapters of Romans chapter 5. You look at Paul from the very moment of his conversion. What God says to Ananias about going over, you know, and see this fellow Saul, you know, and Ananias calls a timeout and says, "Wait, you must not be paying attention, you know. This is the guy who's doing all this, wreaking all this havoc." And God says, "I will. He's a chosen vessel. I will show him how much he must suffer for my sake." And for those who say, "Well, suffering ought not be a part of the Christian life," there's God saying it about one of his chosen vessels, right?
Well, I think again, it speaks to the reality that in the world of the biblical narrative, in Paul's world, in Ananias's world, in the world of the disciples, in the world of Job, suffering was assumed. It was assumed that suffering was part of life. Now, there are different ways in which, I mean, the ancients, they would say, well, if you're suffering, it's because the gods are angry with you. It's because there's something about you. This is in John chapter 9, when Jesus and the disciples come upon a man born blind. And the first question out of their mouth was, who sinned such that this man is born blind? There was no sense in which his blindness could possibly be a doorway into beauty and goodness. Suffering only was a sign of God's condemnation. And Jesus answers them and says, actually, this man was born blind such that the works of God might be revealed in him. When God talks to Ananias about how much Paul will suffer, that suffering is taking place in a context in which Paul first has an encounter with Jesus on the Damascus Road, in which Jesus has a conversation with him. And we hear that conversation, Paul, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? We hear it, depending upon our own ways of hearing, you know, thinking about how this story unfolds, it's easy for us to imagine that Jesus, in fact, is like upset with Paul. Why are you persecuting me? But what if the voice that Paul was hearing was a voice of compassion? What if it was a voice of Jesus basically getting underneath Paul's story and saying, all the work that you're doing, persecuting me, my friend, come home to what's really going on here. And Paul, having the experience of being loved by God through the person of Jesus in a way that he never had been, is part of what Paul experiences that enables him to write the words that he writes in the first two verses of Romans chapter 5, this notion that this faith and this justification that are really an expression of trust and secure attachment with God lead to this experience of glory. Glory, not just that in which we say God is a wonderful God, God is a beautiful God, God is a powerful God, all of which is true. But it is also true that God is a God who directs his delight at us. We are the objects of his delight. And our brokenness makes it really difficult for us to be aware of this. But we recognize that in the text of Romans 5, 1 through 5, that by the time we get to Paul's words about how suffering leads to perseverance and so forth, that suffering is predicated with this notion of God's glory, that we hope in the glory of God. We sit in this notion that we are the objects of his utter delight. And that's what we are based again. This is what we are paying attention to in the context of a community in which we hear the voice of Jesus in the other members of the body of Jesus. We see the sight line of Jesus' gaze in the body of Jesus. And in that context, our experience of suffering is transformed because it begins with our utter awareness of our being God's delight.
As you can tell, we are in deep weeds, friend. We are in really deep weeds with Dr. Kurt Thompson today, because this is exactly where we all live and we struggle. And I was thinking before the program, we had a phone call from a listener whose daughter went missing in June. Sheena and Valerie had called. And I looked up just before we started here to see if there's any more news. And there's no more other than the different authorities that have gotten involved. You talk about suffering, the suffering of a mom who doesn't know, where's my daughter? What has happened to her? And she is sitting in the middle of that. You know, that's a real issue. Or if you're dealing with a debilitating illness today, as you listen, if you're going through marital discord, or a child has abandoned you and said, I don't care what you think about me, I don't believe in God, and you turn their back on you and your... All of that suffering, I want you to filter through the conversation today with Dr. Kurt Thompson. The Deepest Place is our featured resource, chrisfabrylive.org. What do you do with the suffering in your life, the suffering that you're experiencing right now? Dr. Kurt Thompson has written, he's the author of The Soul of Shame, so we're going to get to shame here today. But he's written just an amazing book titled The Deepest Place, Suffering and the Formation of Hope. We've been talking about this topic over the last few months, but I want you to hear his take on suffering, on Dr. Thompson's take on it, because I think what I have done and what I've seen others do is try to minimize the suffering by comparing it with other people's suffering. Well, I don't have as bad as, you know, and somebody who has had this deep loss, well, my loss is not as big as that. And so I take comfort in the fact that somebody else has it worse than I do. Or so the comparison, or the minimizing, the drowning out, the squelching. I used to, Dr. Thompson, when I was a kid, I had a CB radio. And when you get on the channel, the frequency that you're on, you hear this just rabid noise, this radio noise that's there, until you turn up the squelch. And you turn up the squelch, and all of that goes away so that you only hear what people are saying. The threshold of the noise floor is still there, but you've squelched it out. And we do that with, we can numb it, like you said, with your phone, with social media, with pornography, or with some substance, alcohol, etc. But it's a way to try to get that out of our lives. And I think what you are encouraging us to do, kicking and screaming, you're encouraging us to be all here in the middle of the mess. Am I getting that right? Mm-hmm.
You're right. And Chris, in some respects, this really goes back to the first two pages of the Bible, when we recognize that, in the 18th verse of the second chapter, where God says, it's not good for the human to be alone. It's not good for the human to be alone. This is a primal statement that carries throughout the history of the world, because so much of what our suffering is about has to do with our experience of isolation, has to do with the sense that I am alone in my pain. It's not just that I experience pain, it's that I experience pain in isolation by myself in the privacy of my own head. And then I begin to tell all kinds of stories about myself and about my pain, including, for instance, what you suggest, this notion that, well, my pain's not as bad as my neighbor's pain, and so therefore it doesn't mean anything. And so we find all kinds of ways to disconnect from our pain rather than allowing others to be with us in our pain. When we talk about the notion of atonement, that word atonement, which not just means paying the price for a sin, but it also means the capacity of God to be fully with us, because it comes from the old English word at one meant. This notion that Jesus and the Holy Trinity are fully at one with us. But it is difficult for us to allow ourselves to be loved. We look around in our world and we see that it's, you know, it doesn't take much to see that we're not very good at loving each other. But we are even less capable, surprisingly enough, we are even less capable of allowing ourselves to be loved.
Yes.
As odd as that might sound, given all of our pop music, all of our literature, all of our movies, all of my longing to be loved, the reality is that the moment that it gets close to me, the moment that Jesus actually gets close to me, it becomes at some level even more terrifying than my brokenness. Because he's about to walk into rooms, through doors, into spaces where my pain, my suffering is, along with the shame that contains it and wraps it up. And that I have practiced being afraid of. I've been practicing being afraid of God. I'm not just afraid, like I've practiced being afraid. And that leaves me in isolation. And so the first, you know, we talk about there are different parts of how the mind works that is part of our suffering. One of it has to do with our capacity to tell time. I can just imagine that I'm going to be in pain for a long time down the road. These are things that, for instance, we don't believe that a dog or an elk is imagining. In the same way that I also have this sense of the story that I tell about it, which includes there's nothing I can do about my pain because I am alone with it. And so evil will want to hijack my way of telling time and my isolation and the story that I tell about both. I'm going to be alone with my pain indefinitely as a way for me to continue to suffer. But the moment someone else steps into that suffering and says, tell me where you are. Tell me where you are. Now I am looking at someone's gaze who is loving me in the very moment that I'm suffering. And the suffering itself in that moment is transformed. Take, for example, the woman with the bleeding problem in Mark chapter 5. She has a plan for her healing. And the plan is like commando healing. We're going to get in, get the job done, get out. Nobody's going to notice. Until Jesus stops her, stops the crowd, and that's when things get difficult for her because she didn't plan on him coming for as much of her suffering as he's coming for. She only thought that her big problem was her bleeding, and as it turns out, her shame, her social isolation, her not being a daughter anymore, her not being married, her not having children, all of those huge shaming, social debilitating realities, she's not even imagining that there's any antidote for that suffering. But Jesus turns and says, stop. And then he looks for who did that. And the text reads, in fear and trembling, she comes to him. This whole notion that to allow ourselves to truly be open to Jesus, if we're honest about it, it means he's going to name the things that we give to him with fear and trembling. The beautiful thing about this, Chris, is that as we practice allowing ourselves to be seen fully, vulnerably, in the context of the body of Jesus, which of course many of our listeners might say, look, I've tried the body of Jesus. That just creates more trouble. I'd like to find a way to not be suffering, and I just don't want other people to be involved. And we would say, there is no other option. That our suffering is intended to be met with the voice and the touch and the sight line of Jesus, and that's what the body of Christ is intended to be about.
There's a beautiful story that you tell of Cheney, who went through just some horror in her childhood And she has been doing it. She has been alone with her suffering for a long time. Tell that story here briefly.
Well, she indeed had a series of events that happened to her in her older childhood years that brought her to a place where she was really effective at life, really effective at all the things that we easily have benchmarks for and have metrics for in terms of what she was doing for a living and how she was doing it, so forth and so on. But her body was paying a price for that, and she came to see me for these symptoms that she was having. And what became clear pretty quickly was that she had an entire story locked away in a vault that she was having to burn energy containing all of that suffering regarding all those things that had happened to her. And all she wanted when she came in to see me, she just wanted a solution for her presenting medical problem. That's all she wanted. She had no idea of the vast ocean of suffering that was behind her brain's wall that was starting to eke its way out through some of the symptoms that she was having. And what we began to do was to little by little by little invite her to have a conversation and put words to those parts of her story that were so overwhelming, so shaming for her. But eventually, we invited her to take this same work, not just with me individually, but into a group that we call a confessional community. It's a group of about 6 or 8 people that we are helping to facilitate, in which she's now having to tell this story initially to people who are total strangers, but that she is trusting are going to be willing to listen to her. And what's so striking about this is that the very beginning of her telling her story, she's terrified of what people are going to think, until she starts to see their responses literally in their faces, hear their voices of compassion across the room. And for the first time ever, Chaney has an experience in a room full of people, not just with one dude, not just with me, who's paid, right? This is the thing, right? That, you know, well, you're my psychiatrist. Like, you're paid to be nice to me. You're paid to have these all kinds of things. And these are people who are just like Chaney. She's not paying them to be compassionate. And this is the first time she has a group of people, a wall of people, a body of believers who are literally using the physics of relationship, multiple brains in the room, multiple minds in the room, the body of Jesus that began to encounter her in such a way that she sensed in her very body things that she had never sensed before. This felt sense of being seen and soothed, made to feel safe and secure in that room, revealing her story. And this led to tears. And of course, many of us, you know, we're embarrassed about our tears, because our tears remind us of parts of our lives that are embarrassing, when we've wept in ways that have not been seen or made to feel secure or soothed. And her tears first began as tears of embarrassment. But when those folks in the room stayed with her, she began to notice her own transformation of relief, that they weren't leaving the room. Nobody was being critical. Nobody was making fun of her. They continued to welcome her story into the room. And this, Chris, I would say, is exactly what the work of the gospel is about. This is what Jesus was doing with the woman with the bleeding problem. It wasn't enough for him that her bleeding was stopped. That wasn't her biggest problem. He was inviting her entire story out into the open for him to come and find it and call her daughter for the first time, I'm sure, in over 12 years. And this is what the work of the body of Jesus intends to do with all of our suffering. And, you know, like I like to remind people, look, healing is a disruptive technology in the Bible. We look at these healing stories of Jesus and we think, oh, this is fabulous. Right? The woman, her bleeding problem was stopped. The man born blind in John 9, he can see. You know, the guy who he heals in John 7, the lame guy, like, this is awesome. Except when you actually start to think about it, you now have a blind guy in John 9 who gets his sight back And at the end of the chapter, he's thrown out of his community. Not only that, he has made a living. He has made a living begging by the side of the road. Now he can see he's got no job. He's got no skill set. The woman who's caught in adultery in John 8, where are your accusers? There are none. Neither do I accuse you. Go and sin no more. Jesus is heroic. The problem is, how is she now going to feed her kids?
Yes. And that is the perfect place to push pause on this segment with Dr. Kurt Thompson, our guest on Chris Fabry Live. Our featured resource is his book, The Deepest Place, Suffering and the Formation of Hope. You can go to the website to find out more, chrisfabrylive.org. Our program today is recorded, but I'm guessing this Best Up broadcast is a dose of hope for you and perhaps something you're going through right now. Thanks for joining us at the Radio Backyard Fence. Again, go to the website, chrisfabrylive.org. More straight ahead on Moody Radio. I want to tell you a little bit about CareNet today. If you go to the website, chrisfabrylive.org, we have a green CareNet button there, chrisfabrylive.org. They call themselves Pro-Abundant Life. And let me illustrate it by the story that we just heard, this story about Chaney. Chaney, her name's been changed in the book, but she was at a boarding school. She was bullied by the older girls. And then later on, she was taken advantage of sexually by an older boy that she had turned to kind of give her emotional support. And then she became pregnant. And then she had an abortion. And it was in that community of people who were looking at her, who were accepting the really hard parts of her story that she didn't even want to tell anybody, that the life began to come back into Chaney's eyes and in her life and really begin to live the forgiven life. The same thing happens with CareNet. Now, they're all about saving babies. It's something, since 2008, it's something like more than a million babies that have been saved because of all of the work that CareNet has done. But they're not just about the babies. They're about the moms, the unexpected pregnancy that the woman has. They're about the unexpected pregnancy that the guy finds out and who maybe pushes her toward an abortion. And then years down the road, they feel the weight of this. It is for all of the people involved as well as others around them. I'm just telling you, CareNet is one of the ministries that I'm slowly getting my eyes open to. If you click that green CareNet button, you'll find out more. There's some really encouraging things, especially if abortion is one of the big issues for you in life. But you say, I don't know what to do. Click CareNet today, chrisfabrylive.org. Dr. Kurt Thompson, psychiatrist, speaker, author. He's written the book that was kind of a breakout book, The Soul of Shame. His latest is The Deepest Place. So I want to go from Chaney's story, though, to your own story. And you wait for 100 pages to kind of peel back the onion on your own life. And before we even go into that, tell me, when you were a kid growing up, what did you want to do? Did you want to be a psychiatrist, a neurologist?
Wow, Chris, you know, no, I didn't even know that psychiatry was a thing. I went off to medical school, not really sure that that was what I wanted to do, and wasn't even considering psychiatry. And when I started my psychiatric rotation, by the time I got there, I was really quite uncertain about what I was going to do and felt, in fact, a little bit lost. Here I was, you know, 2.5 years into medical school, not really sure that I even wanted to be there, not really sure that I was cut out to do this. And as I have said about many moments in my life, that Jesus has been coming to find me in very significant, powerful ways, and in particular moments. And one of the moments in which I believe Jesus came to find me and to get my attention was when I started my psychiatric rotation in medical school. And it felt like lots of tumblers fell in the lock for me, this longing to understand how we operate as human beings, meshed with my love for science and the way the body works. And this then was, you know, something that was I've just grown to love, and I feel humbled that I'm able to do this kind of work. But it was not what I was thinking about when I was a kid. I think for the most part, I was just kind of wondering, like, what would life be, but without a lot of guidance in the beginning parts of my life.
Did you feel alone when you were a kid?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Chris. There's a sense in which, looking back on it, I don't know that that I was consciously aware of how alone I actually was. I was not a kid who was depressed. I was a kid who generally, I think if you would have asked me, like, do you enjoy your life, when I was 10 or when I was 14, I would have said, yes, I enjoy my life. Now, it's also equally true that there were parts of my life that from which I was pretty cut off, things that I felt like. So, for instance, I grew up in a house where both of my parents had, they were God-fearing Jesus lovers who were imperfect. And there were many things about my family life that were wonderful. And then there were things that were a bit maddening. But I'm only later in my life did I become aware of what some of those maddening things actually were. For instance, I grew up in a house where my mom was pretty anxious. And my dad was, though deeply affectionate, could also be pretty stern. So I grew up learning to be afraid of anger and learning to be worried about anxiety, if you will. And so then you end up having, and so the parts of my own story where I would feel angry or feel anxious were not really ever parts that I could talk about. So these were parts of me that got isolated and cut off, which meant, you know, there were all kinds of things that should have been happening in my life. One of the well-known conversations when I was about 15 years of age, and my mom came to me one day and said, you know, your dad has asked me, why is it that you will talk to me about certain things and you won't talk to him? And I kind of paused. Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, I'm only 15 years old, and I look at her and say, do you hear what you're asking me? And what was so striking was
just made me a psychiatrist, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. My training started at a very young age. And after that, what was so interesting is nothing ever came of that. Like, nobody ever came back around and had a further conversation about this. And so I learned that, again, without consciously knowing this, I learned that there were lots of things like, what do you do about women and sex? And what do you do about your longing to be, you know, a person of significance in the world, and what you're going to do for a living and where you're going to go to college? All these kinds of things were things that I was pretty much processing on my own. And again, because you don't know anything different, you don't necessarily know that you are alone until you discover that you're not, when you encounter Jesus. And then you start looking behind you and you start to see all kinds of trails that you've left in your family of origin, in which things happened that shouldn't have, and in which things, in my case, in a lot of respects, in which things didn't happen that should have. And when that takes place, you discover, man, I have by myself, when it comes to feelings of sadness and grief. I mean, I lost my dad when I was 17. I've lost three older brothers to cancer. I mean, you just come to learn that, like, no, this is a thing that you're just going to have to take care of on your own, because nobody is coming for you with the exception of Jesus. The challenge, of course, is, you know, as far as the brain is concerned, the brain pays a lot of attention to the things that we pay a lot of attention to. And if I am practicing living in my mind as if I am alone most of the time, the fact that Jesus and I have encounters every now and then doesn't really give my brain the option to countermand that, if most of the work that it's doing is the work of persuading it that it's by itself. So this is kind of like the way Chaney was. Chaney learned, she practiced learning that she was by herself with her pain. She practiced this, and she needed to in order to survive. It's only when she started to encounter someone first with me and then with this confessional community, in which people were genuinely coming for parts of her heart that she had isolated from herself and from everybody else, that literally her brain and her soul started to wake up to things. But of course, what's challenging about this is that our deepest longings for connection, those intimacy longings that we have for your relationship, remember, it's not good for the man to be alone. That longing is often the very place where our wounds have also taken place. Chaney's deepest wounds took place in the context of intimate relationships with her boyfriend, with her friends at school, in which she was bullied, like these close proximal relationships. And so we come to learn that as much as I long for intimacy, it's also dangerous. And so I practice surviving. And in some respects, that's what I had to do. And to this day, Chris, I mean, we come up with all kinds of coping strategies for these things that are troubling. So I've come to discover I am now 60 years old, and I have come only recently to discover, for instance, just how often and everywhere I use envy as a way for me to cope with the parts of me that I still feel like that I still feel inadequate. Like I envy like the person who gets invited to speak at places that I don't get to speak to, the person who gets a bigger advance on their book than I get, the person who's more, you know, the most interesting person in the room if I'm not more interesting. Like the thing, I'm not the smartest guy in the room. Like all the, like it's just everywhere. And all of this, to be envious, is a way for me to cope with the parts of me with which I suffer in isolation. But if I'm willing to practice vulnerably opening those spaces, this is what, when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 2 and 3, there are those who know, who do not know, those who think they know, who do not know as they ought. But the one who loves God, the person who loves God, is known by God. Notice, it's not the person who loves God, knows God, is known by God. They have the experience of being deeply seen, soothed, safe, secure in all the places that they hate the most, and have the experience of being loved in that space. And this is where suffering meets its match in Jesus. Jesus comes and says to us, I see your suffering and I am not leaving the room. And I want to say, well, you have no idea how long this has been. You have no idea how horrible this has been. And he might say, I might know more than you know. I just know I'm not leaving the room. I know that I'm going to continue to be with you in the presence of this. And we eventually discover that the worst part about our suffering is not the pain that we experience, but our deep sense that we are alone with it.
Yes. You have so many great quotes throughout, you know, from believers throughout the centuries. I want to come back, but one of the main questions that I had for you that I wanted to deal with today is that penchant that we have for making sense of our own suffering, of figuring out why something bad happened in our life. Well, this happened because of this, and God did this, and that, and we fit all the puzzle pieces together. And so when we come back, I want you to answer that question. I got a quote for you. This is really, really good stuff today with Dr. Kurt Thompson. The Deepest Place is our featured resource. You'll find it at chrisfabrylive.org. I think what we're talking about today, it's weird to think of it this way, but when Jesus said that I came to give them life and life abundant, that's part of what we're talking about with our suffering. Dr. Kurt Thompson has written The Deepest Place, Suffering and the Formation of Hope. We're just kind of scratching the surface. As a matter of fact, there's so many great quotes in here, and Mark in Illinois wanted to add one. Mark, go right ahead. Why'd you call today?
Yeah, this is a George MacDonald quotation, and it begins C.S. Lewis's The Problem of Pain. And for those who know the quotation, I'm going to alter one word just to make it more understandable to the modern mind. the Son of Man suffered unto death, not so that we would not suffer, but so that our suffering would be more like his. And Lewis later says in the book, God whispers in our pleasures, speaks in our suffering, and shouts in our pain. Pain is God's megaphone to arouse a deaf world. And I would follow on with 2 points. Number one, it's interesting that Lewis represents pain as one of the ways that God amplifies his voice. And the other is that I would contend that if God shouts in our pains, he sings in our ecstasies.
That's really good, Mark. I'm glad you called. So, Kurt, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, Chris, I think what Mark's getting at, I think, is what our common experience is, that we like to say in the work that we do with patients is that, you know, when people come to the office, they come and they mostly want to be relieved of their symptoms. But that's very different than coming wanting to be well. And we often, we say that, like, people begin to make the changes that they need to make once they have suffered enough. And if someone is not making the changes that they claim that they want to make or that they need to make, it's because at some level they haven't suffered enough. It doesn't mean that they haven't suffered, but it means that they haven't suffered, you know, enough of through a threshold of suffering that really is evoking the kind of change. What the kind of suffering that we talk about when in recovery room, in the recovery of from addictions, when we reach that rock bottom place. And so this notion that God has built into the fabric of creation a painful stimulus, a painful response when we are living in a way that is apart from the way we were made to live, you know, really just makes a lot of sense. The real question, of course, is when that pain comes, whether God is talking to us or God is shouting at us through his megaphone, the real question is how we are going to respond. Because I have all kinds of ways. When someone shouts at me through a megaphone, I may, like, it may get my attention or it may have me running away. And the question is whether or not I'm going to respond by coming toward God. And that has everything to do, again, with what we're doing in response to the body of Jesus that can be Jesus for us in those moments of suffering.
The question that I posed before the break, I can deal with my suffering if I can make sense of it. I can deal, you know, as I look at the cross, I can if I'm giving my life for the sins of the world, that it's okay. Well, I can understand that, and Jesus had that. I don't have that. I don't understand what's going on here and the cause and effect. And is it my fault? Is this something that God's? Is the enemy doing it? You know, all those questions. But I think a lot of times we comfort ourselves by thinking, oh, I may have made sense of my suffering because this happened and this happened and this happened. And even that we're not promised to understand in totality as humans, right?
Well, not only are we not promised that, Chris, but it actually doesn't even follow the rules of the way the neurological system of the brain, central nervous system, work. As we like to say, first of all, is that the human body, first, we sense things, and only then do we make sense of what we sense. And so when we feel whatever it is that we feel, especially if we are suffering, if we're having sensations, right, this is the physical or an emotional perception of distress over time. If I'm having that experience and someone gives me information, or even explains to me why I'm having the pain, the fact that someone says, Kurt, here's the reason why your femur is fractured, the explanation in no way, shape, or form reduces my suffering of my fractured femur. My knowing about it isn't what it needs. What I need is surgery. When my son doesn't come back from Iraq, there's no explanation that's going to be enough. What we need is presence. When we look at John 11, I mean, it's a classic example of Jesus encountering two sisters after their brother has died who are in their suffering. And Martha first has this encounter that becomes this theological conversation with Jesus. And Martha doesn't stick around long enough in her own grief. Jesus is trying to get to that. It's not until Mary comes and simply, after saying, "If you had only been here," she just returns to her weeping. There's no asking for an explanation. There's simply grief in which Jesus joins her. And then he moves.
That is really good. I don't think I've thought a bit about it that way in the moving into, and that's what God wants. And here we are at the end of the program. We only scratched the surface here, but this is freeing. It really is not making sense of the suffering. It is allowing God to do in us and through us what he wants, which is glory, and you develop that in the book. Dr. Thompson, thank you for the conversation today, for the hope that is here, for the abundant life that is here. Keep doing what you're doing and come back and see us again, okay?
We'd love to, Chris. Thanks so much.
Dr. Kurt Thompson, our guest today on this Best Of broadcast of Chris Fabry Live, our featured resource at the website, The Deepest Place, Suffering and the Formation of Hope. It's one of the best reads of the last year for me, but this message is difficult to embrace. I'd rather talk about the happiest place. I'd rather go to the path of least suffering and pain. But for some reason, God allows this in our lives. And as you've already heard in this hour, the place of growth, the place of transformation comes in the hard spots. And if you're going through one right now, God bless you, friend. I think this will encourage you even more as you get into it, The Deepest Place. Go to the website, chrisfabrylive.org. Click today's info. You'll find out more about the book and Dr. Thompson. And thanks for listening. Remember, Chris Fabry Live is a production of Moody Radio, a ministry of Moody Bible Institute.